From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, we'll find out how the city of Oakland is going to pay an old debt to its pensioners.
It's my livelihood. It's what I have to live on for the rest of my life.
Then we'll meet a collector of old movie posters that feature our city by the bay.
I find older posters so much more interesting than new posters. It's the work generally of anonymous artists working in the art department at these studios.
And we'll stop by a weekly silent film screening. Here's a clip. Don't worry, we'll break the silence. We're Cross Currents. Stay tuned. In a recent press conference, Mayor Gene Kwan proudly presented Oakland's balanced budget.
I'm pleased to say that today we are not making any cuts to any major program. We are not laying off anybody. In fact, we're making a few modest personnel increases.
Still, Kwan acknowledged that the city is short more than $2.5 billion. Half of that money is for things like road repairs, storm drains, and sewer maintenance. The rest would fund employee pensions and health care. Basically, Kwan said that the city has enough money, and also that it doesn't. For a little perspective on this, we decided to find someone with more information.
My name is John Russo, and I'm the city manager of Alameda, California.
John Russo used to be Oakland's city attorney. He was also on the city council from 1995 to 2000, and he knows a lot about Oakland's finances.
They're effectively bankrupt now. Everybody understands bankruptcy is when you can't pay your bills. Oakland can't pay its bills.
Bankruptcy is a loaded word, so let's be very clear here. Oakland isn't bankrupt yet. It hasn't defaulted on its debts. There are no creditors threatening to repossess City Hall, like Wells Fargo did in the city of Stockton. As the mayor said, there are some economic bright spots. But Russo says they're not bright enough.
Oakland can't perform 911 services. I don't think there's a person in urban America anywhere who would say that a city that cannot respond to a 911 call for help is fiscally sound.
Since 2010, Oakland police hasn't responded to burglary calls unless they're in progress. The department doesn't have a dedicated homicide unit. It's cut its police force to less than half what comparable cities have. For example, Detroit, with a population about twice the size of Oakland's, has a force that's about four times bigger. And the city still has bills it can't pay. One of the most problematic is an old account for retired police and firefighters. Reporter Charlie Mintz explains why.
If you took the fund now and if you paid the pension obligation throughout, it would last maybe 5 years. And then they'd run out of money.
Oakland Police Sergeant Bob Crawford is 73 years old. He's still patrolling his East Oakland beat, and he looks like he could put me in a wicked half Nelson. But he plans to retire soon. And the pension system that's supposed to take care of him, it's short half $1 billion.
It's my livelihood. It's what I have to live on for the rest of my life.
The system Crawford's talking about is the Police and Fire Retirement System, or PFERS. It started in 1951 and closed in 1976, but it's still paying benefits to about 1,100 former police and firefighters, plus one active police officer. That's Crawford. Compared to CalPERS, the state-run pension system Oakland police and firefighters are on now, PFERS is small, but it's going to cost the city at least $100 million this year alone.
Those of us that have pensions get paid less. You know, and part of our pay is the pension. So it's money that we earned, and it's a contract. So it's something that, you know, it's an obligation.
The city funds PFERS with the property tax. Ideally, that tax on its own would be enough. But the city's also using that money to pay off loans it used to help fund PFERS in the past. And it's too much debt for the city to handle. To pay for PFERS this year, the city would have to cut almost 10% of its budget. Next year, that number would be even higher.
Contact your city council representatives and tell them you love your library.
Yay!
No cuts to libraries! No cuts to libraries! No cuts to libraries!
In 2010, Oakland did make big cuts.
In Oakland, hundreds of city workers protested at City Hall late today over a budget vote that could have cost them their jobs.
Union! We are the union!
It is an 11th hour protest to save their jobs and the city of Oakland as they know it. In a sign of just how dire the budget crisis here is, 14 of the city's 18 libraries could be shut down.
Legally, the city has to fund PFERS. The only way out of it would be to declare bankruptcy, which the city's not going to do, or to pass a law saying that they won't pay. That's what San Jose voters did earlier this month. But Oakland's considering a third option. Here's Oakland Assistant City Administrator Scott Johnson.
We have a proposal to issue pension obligation bonds. Basically, we're proposing to issue so that we pre-fund about 5 years worth of contributions at the tune of about $210 million.
In short, a loan. The plan is for Oakland to borrow about $210 million on the global bond market. They'd pay all that money to PFERS up front and get some breathing room before the next big contribution comes due 5 years from now.
We really believe that this is the most responsible plan. And it's more of a long-term structure. It's not kicking the can down the road. It's really matching up the special revenues that come in to paying the obligations as they become due.
For this plan to work, two things need to happen over the next 5 years. First, the economy needs to get better. That would get Oakland some much-needed property tax dollars. Remember, those property tax dollars are what fund PFERS. Second, the stock market has to grow. If the PFERS funds earn more in the stock market than the cost of the loan, then problem solved. If not, the city owes the amount of the loan plus interest plus what it still owes to PFERS. The plan has support from the retired police and firefighters in the system, but critics say it's a risky move.
Would you borrow money against your house and use that money to invest in the stock market?
Daniel Bornstein is a columnist for the Contra Costa Times. He's come out strongly against pension obligation bonds.
They may win the bet, they may lose the bet. But what they need to do first is evaluate the risk of the bet in dollars and cents so that the city council and the mayor and the citizens, the residents of the city all understand how much is being placed at risk. In other words, how would they pay the bill if they lose the bet again?
Notice how he said again. Oakland has done this before. In 1997, the city issued about $400 million in pension obligation bonds. The point, just like today, was to buy it some breathing room. The city put all the money into PFERS and got a pension holiday. 14 years where it didn't have to pay anything. Sounds good, right? I mean, who doesn't want to go on holiday? It's not totally clear, though, whether the city could afford that vacation. In 2010, the city auditor issued a report saying the bonds and the holiday had set the city back $250 million.
There's no doubt. The city is in deep financial trouble right now. But this gamble could put them in much worse financial shape 3 and 4 years and 5 years down the line.
Whether or not the 1997 bonds were good for the city, it's still risky to issue them now. If the stock market goes down, the city is stuck with a huge debt. So Oakland has a choice. Make painful cuts now, or take a bet that the future will be better. In Oakland, I'm Charlie Mintz for CrossCurrents.
Charlie Mintz is with the Stanford Storytelling Project. The Oakland City Council will vote on the bond issue July 3rd. Find more information on our website. It's kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Martina Castro. And now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that's filmed in San Francisco. While The Birds and Vertigo may be some of the more obvious San Francisco films, a new exhibit showing at the Old Mint Building in San Francisco is exploring the obvious, the not-so-obvious, and the downright obscure. The exhibit is entitled The Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of, San Francisco and the Movies. and it shows scripts, collectibles, artwork, and posters from films shot in San Francisco. One room is dedicated to movie posters from classic noir films related to the city by the bay. They belong to local collector, author, filmmaker, and self-proclaimed noir fanatic, Eddie Muller, who has been collecting the posters for decades. KALW's Hana Baba visited the exhibit with Muller and asked him first how many posters he has now.
Far, far too many. hundreds. I have hundreds of posters, but this one on the wall here, Born to Kill, was actually the first noir poster that I consciously sought out and bought. I had done my book, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, and I said, I'm going to treat myself to a poster that I always wanted, and that was the one. Why? I'm not entirely sure. The poster always just really appealed to me. And
that led to the next and the next.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you understand the psychology of this. Yes, you're, as I put it, you're always chasing the dragon because it's like, oh, well, now. And it went from the one to, well, there are four, right? And the one next to it, Raw Deal, was one of the original quartet, along with The Strange Love of Martha Ivers and Nightmare Alley. Those were the four posters, and then I'll call it off.
Those are the ones that started it all. How did you choose which ones you would bring here to the Mint?
There has to be some connection to San Francisco. I mean, that was the point of the exhibit, right? So Born to Kill, set in San Francisco. Raw Deal, parts of it are in San Francisco. A complete fantasy vision of San Francisco. None of it was shot here. None of Raw Deal was shot here. Born to Kill, parts of the film were definitely shot here. They arrive on the ferry, and there's a scene at the ferry building, and there's a scene at the old Sutro Mansion out by the Cliff House, and there's a scene at Ocean Beach.
There's a kind of corruptness inside of you, Sam.
That'd drive most women off if they understood like you do.
Yes.
But not you. You have guts. Georgia told me how you found those two in Reno. You had guts then. You didn't yell or faint.
No.
And it wasn't only finding them dead. It was the way they were dead. The kid jammed in the doorway. The Palmer dame lying there under the sink.
Blood on her hair.
Blood all over the place, and you didn't yell.
No, I didn't.
Helen.
So yes, Born to Kill definitely uses San Francisco. And the poster on the end, Woman on the Run, is shot entirely in San Francisco. And it's a really, really terrific movie that we frankly rediscovered here at the Noir City Film Festival. The first year we did the festival, nobody had seen Woman on the Run in decades, and it was a film that I really sought out, and it took quite a while to unearth the only existing print of the film. And so that poster, I was happy to find that as well. That was not easy to locate.
And how do you find them? Do you just go on eBay, or how do you find them?
This is revealing my age now. None of this stuff was accessible on the internet. I mean, I wrote my book, Dark City, 12 years ago, right? You couldn't find this stuff on eBay 12 years ago. So, I mean, when I was really starting to look for these things, I mean, I found that Woman on the Run poster in a bookstore in Los Angeles, you know, and there were dealers who would have like poster collections in their garages and stuff, and I would, you know, search these people out and go and talk to them, and you know, there was this shared obsession that we all had. Now it's really easy because of eBay and the internet. I mean, it's insanely easy now.
When did you start becoming obsessed and a lover of films?
Well, it's funny. If you want to go back to the first film, it wouldn't be very noirish. I think it was Yogi Bear and Jellystone Park or something like that. I don't know. So it was in my early teens, I think. And I would cut school. And I would decide what day I was going to skip school by looking at TV Guide. And if the movie had night, street, city, big, any of those words in the title, then I said, oh, I'm probably going to like that one. Because it turns out that, you know, all these film noir movies have those words, the big sleep, the big heat, the big combo, right? Night without sleep, city that never sleeps, the cry of the city, the naked city. I mean, it's just, okay, there you go.
What is it about noir in particular versus other films that did not have those words for you?
Well, the films are all about kind of the dark side of human nature. Now, why that always appeals to me, I don't know. You'll have to talk to my analyst or something. I don't know. But seriously, though, my dad was a newspaper man. He worked, in fact, right in that building right across the street. But he was a newspaper man during that whole era, right, the mid-20th century. And I always felt that the world had changed rather significantly by the time I was a teenager. And I was very, I found his era very appealing to me. And so when I would see all these photographs of him in his prime and out on the town and at the boxing matches and everything, I wanted to know what that was about. And I saw it in these noir films. I saw that world in the noir films. And so I felt like I was watching, you know, home movies or something of my dad.
Tell me about Thieves' Highway and its connection to San Francisco.
Most of the film is shot in the old produce market, down which is now the Embarcadero Center. It used to be the San Francisco Produce Market, where all the people would come. All the wholesalers would have their operations there, and the buyers would come and get all of their vegetables and fruit and everything for their stores. They would go down there. The trains would come in, deliver stuff. Truckers were coming in all the time. And Thieves' Highway is set there, a story about a World War II veteran who comes to San Francisco to get revenge on a crooked produce broker who crippled his father in a trucking accident and cheated him out of his money and then jimmied the brakes or something in the truck so that his dad loses his legs. And then he comes to San Francisco to get revenge with a load of golden delicious apples to sell. Fantastic movie. I this is actually probably the film that started me on my way.
I gotta shut up. Pete's gotta shut up. How about Ed? How about Ed? 4 bits of box. How about Ed?
You're crazy. You busted my hand.
Does my pop have to shut up? Cut off both his legs.
I find older posters so much more interesting than new posters because they did take these odd risks to show things, and they're mostly painted. That's what I enjoy about them, right? That it's the work generally of anonymous artists working in the art department at these studios.
And then there's like the quote, the little quip.
Oh, yeah.
Bullets, women can't hold a man like this.
Yeah, how do bullets hold a man anyway? I don't know. Sometimes they don't even make sense, right? The coldest killer a woman ever loved. Well, that one I get. But bullets, women can't hold a man like this. It's fantastic, of course.
That's noir film expert Eddie Muller showing KALW's Hanah Baba his collection of movie posters, now on display at the exhibit The Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of, San Francisco and the Movies. You can see them for yourself through this Sunday at the Old Mint Building on 5th and Mission in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, and I'm Martina Castro. San Francisco has a long history with movies, going all the way back to the advent of Westerns and silent films. In this piece from our archives, KALW's Art Persico brings us the story of Gilbert Anderson, the star of the first silent Western, and his Bay Area-based SNA Studios. Both are memorialized at a local museum that upholds their legacy to this day.
Good evening and welcome to the Nile SNA Silent Film Museum. And to the Edison Theater.
Tommy Andrew, the host of the weekly silent film screening in Niles, is standing in front of the screen and explaining that this museum is only here because of an actor named Gilbert Anderson.
Gilbert Anderson was in the very first Western that was ever produced. And it was such a fantastic hit, he thought, this is the genre to get into.
Based on that success, Anderson wanted to find an authentic Western location to shoot his films.
So he scouted all over the country, basically coming out west, and discovered Niles Canyon.
Niles was a great location for films, including Westerns, with a train that ran through a nearby canyon, a small town with several saloons, and the availability of real cowboys from the surrounding area who were no longer finding employment in cattle drives and ranching. They were happy to be paid $4 to $5 a day to ride horses and shoot guns for SNA films. Bronco Billy Anderson went on to make over 350 films in Niles in just over 4 years.
And also he discovered talented individual that was a comedian that was showing a lot of promise by the name of Charlie Chaplin.
Niles had a big impact on Charlie Chaplin's career, says David Keene, film historian, author of the book Bronco Billy and the SNA Film Company, and the Niles SNA Silent Film Museum projectionist.
Charlie Chaplin's career really blossomed after joining SNA. He'd made 34 films at the Keystone Company the year before, and they were typical Keystone knockabout comedies. You could see there was a spark of genius in Chaplin, but he was kind of an unlikable character in his Keystone films.
But at Niles, he fell in love with Edna Purviance, and Keene says that love transformed him into the kinder, gentler Chaplin that would achieve worldwide fame. During each week in Niles, the SNA Film Company produced 2 to 5 15-minute one-reelers. The filmmakers shot them in San Francisco using locations like Golden Gate Park, but mostly they filmed in and around the Niles studios built by SNA in 1913. When Chaplin's contract came up for renewal at the end of 1915, SNA wouldn't agree to his salary demands. Chaplin moved on to Los Angeles, and the Niles Film Production Center folded barely 3 months later. But these Bay Area-based films live on thanks to the Niles Silent Film Museum, which screens them every Saturday night. Chuck Ring of Newark comes here twice a month.
It's funny, you know, I had no idea how much I enjoy sitting here watching a movie without no sound. Totally different. I love it.
Alex Alamano of San Leandro attends the films with his father and sometimes his little brother.
Who's your favorite silent film actor?
Buster Keaton.
And why is that?
Because he's like the martial arts guy, you know, doing lots of tricks. Even my brother likes him.
And those presenting the silent films in Niles get to share their passion for them and their skills with the audience. As pianist Judy Rosenberg watches the film, she plays piano, improvising on musical themes she's already written. In a sense, coming to this museum is like stepping into a time machine that takes the audience back to Niles during the years 1913 to 1923. On any Saturday night, you can come to the Niles Edison Nickelodeon Theater and see silent films with live music, just like the audiences of that era. From Niles, for KALW News, this is Art Persico.
Here at Cross Currents, we love movies so much that we did a whole show about them.
Will you tell me something? Has this ever happened to you before?
What?
Falling into San Francisco Bay.
After we aired it, we heard back from a few of you, like Winston Smith, who called to tell us about the Pagoda Palace in Washington Square. He would watch a triple feature there for $2 about 20 years ago. Now, the theater lays vacant. And we also heard from Michelle Richmond.
First voice message.
I love your segment on San Francisco movie theaters. We used to live a block from the Balboa movie theater. And in fact, before we lived in that neighborhood, we lived in the Castro. And we would always drive from the Castro to the Balboa, even though it wasn't the closest theater to us, just because we loved seeing movies there. Then we moved to Daly City. And from Daly City, we would always drive into the city to the Outer Richmond to go to the Balboa. And then when we were looking at houses in the city, we bought a house right by the Balboa, and it was no coincidence that that's where we ended up. I love the seats. We used to go to the double features there. The popcorn is amazing. It's just a real treasure of the city. Thanks.
End of message.
We love hearing from you. Give us a call at 415-264-7106 and just leave us a message. You can also connect with us on Facebook. We're KALW News. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Hanna Ababa, Julie Kane, Archims Konohovs, Lila Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Isaac Silk, Taja Lanier, Audrey Dilling, Lupe Hernandez, Emily Garek, Erica Mu, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Cross Currents theme music is by Oakland's John Santos Quintet, and thanks to City Carshare, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Carshare is on the web at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing right now is being performed by La Peña Community Chorus of Berkeley. I actually used to sing with them. The songs, often in Spanish, are from the Nueva Canción tradition of socially conscious folk music from throughout Latin America. The chorus is performing a benefit concert at La Peña Cultural Center on Saturday at 8 p.m., marking the center's 37th anniversary. For Cross Currents, I'm Martina Castro.